Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Ba-da-ba-da-ba-bop. You're back. You're back with us. Look, Ben's not here, so we could actually sing this entire intro. He can't control us, Christy.
I know. He's going to be sad, though, that he wasn't here, because he likes to do the background music.
He does. I wish I knew where the sound effects were. He's a little sound effect board. Sometimes he uses that.
Yeah.
I used to have a Chris Rock soundboard on my laptop, and I would bring it up, and it was just like one-liners from Chris Rock, and I would sit in staff meetings at the church I worked at, and every once in a while, when it was appropriate, Chris Rock would chime in.
Wait, is it ever appropriate to bring up a Chris Rock sound effect in a church staff meeting?
Appropriateness is in the eye of the Chris Rock soundboard holder.
Okay. That's a good clarification.
Yeah, but you know what? I did an experiment with that soundboard because, you know, like the first time you do it, people are surprised. Second time, people laugh. Third time, there's like residual laughs. And then you get into an indeterminate amount of times where it's no longer funny.
But it's funny to you.
But what the only reason I use the soundboard is because you have to get through the indeterminate not funny. And at some point you break through into funny again.
Hysterical.
But you gotta figure out how to get through that without making people really, really mad at you. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of challenge I need in order to get through a staff meeting, because otherwise I'm bored out of my mind.
That is funny. Oh my goodness.
But now I crack jokes, because honestly, when I sit in meetings and we're talking about things, my brain freaks out. Like my ADHD brain is like, give me something to do.
Yeah.
And so I tend to walk into them. Yeah, just bring in my treadmill.
Yes. They have those. I actually was just looking at this the other day. They have these treadmills that you put underneath your desk. They're like really small. And you just like, if you have a stand-up desk, you just like walk and type and do
all. I've got one right here next to me.
Come on. Do you use it a lot?
Yeah, check this thing out.
Yes. Oh no. The one I had is like, or the one I saw was like literally portable. It was like,
oh.
It was almost like smaller than what I have. Yeah, it was just the bottom part of it, not like you don't have any handles or you could just fall, I guess.
Interesting.
But anyway, I was looking at it because I think that that'd be great. And I have kind of been changing. Instead of meeting people for coffee for work, I've been like, hey, let's go for a walk. Because of that, because I'm like, I need to move my body. Maybe you just need to have all your staff meetings like on a hike.
I do my best thinking when I'm walking.
See? So
if I have a phone call, I will take it on a walk.
Yes,
if I can.
Yes.
I've got to move my body.
Yeah.
These are the kinds of things that would have helped me the first 45 years of my life.
Come on. Yeah, I hear that.
But you know, now that I'm on the back end, the back nine, the downslope, now that I'm heading towards Hades, I do think that I am figuring some things out on how to be a better human.
Hey, well done.
How's your mouth?
Oh my gosh. That just put me in a bad mood.
I'm sorry.
You guys, I have to have a root canal. And it's on a tooth that I have like a crown on. I'm like, how does that happen? Like, how does bacteria
isn't the crown supposed to work?
Yeah, that's what I thought. The crown is only 2 years old. They're actually like looking to see if like somehow I get money back or something because it didn't work.
Yeah.
So insurance is, I don't know. Anyway, she was looking into that. But yeah, I have a root canal, which I should be feeling better, you know, this time tomorrow. But right now, doggone it, man. Mouth pain is crazy. Like it makes the whole side of your mouth hurt. It's so weird.
Yeah.
You can't even tell what tooth it is. You're like, which one is actually hurting? Because they seem to all hurt right now.
How long do you think they're going to do local anesthesia, they're going to give you a root canal, and then how long will your face look like you had a stroke?
I don't know. I'm like, I better eat something right now, because what if I don't eat the rest of the day?
Well, yes, although some people get nauseous when these things happen.
Yeah, I kind of feel nauseous just talking about it, to be honest.
All right. Well, maybe this will make you feel better. Soren picked a college, yeah?
Oh, your oldest. That makes me nauseous too. Just how expensive it is. That's what I'm talking about.
I was talking to Paul about this, and he told me how much tuition, room, and board is. And I know it's expensive.
Yes.
But good Lord.
Yeah. Yeah. Soren's going to Baylor, and we're super excited, and he's super excited. And I think it's like a great choice, but he has spent literally hours applying for more scholarship because of how expensive it is.
Yes.
And he's like a great student and like, you know, good grades and just, I don't know. But I'm like, come on, give him some more money, people.
Yeah.
Show me the money.
Show me the money. Well, I was talking to my friend Wednesday night about this, about Soren going to Baylor, because we have my friend, I was telling, we have a mutual friend whose daughter is finishing her freshman year at Baylor.
Oh, nice.
And they're from Grand Rapids.
Okay.
And so I was like, you know, these people who don't live, you know, in Waco are going to Baylor, and they love it, by the way.
Aww.
They love it. My friend Chris, whose daughter is at Xavier, he was telling me that Hope College from your neck of the woods, they've got something called Hope Freedom. Have you heard about this Hope Freedom?
Yes. I mean, Baylor needs that.
So basically, your tuition is free.
Yes. 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 But it's only for like so many students.
Yeah.
But Baylor needs to, come on, Baylor Freedom. Let's go.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of energy in our house right now. My son's a sophomore. He's getting 2 mailings per day from colleges all over the country.
Yep.
And, you know, we're thinking about, my wife and I are thinking about how we, I think I can get about 13 grand for my kidney. So that's in my back pocket. Well, it's close to my back pocket.
Oh, man.
Anyway. I hope your root canal goes well.
Thank you.
And I hope that you have money to pay for that after Soren enrolls in college.
No more teeth problems after he starts college, I guess.
Oh, my gosh. Well.
But today, there's no good segue. But today.
Sure. You know who doesn't need a root canal? Is Reverend Brandon Robertson. He's an author, activist, and theologian known as the TikTok Pastor. He hosts the Faith for the Rest of Us podcast and has authored or contributed to 26 books, Ooh-hoo. Including the Indies Book of the Year finalist True Inclusion. His work appears in Time, The Huffington Post, and The Washington Post. He was named Rolling Stone's 2021 hot list. He speaks at venues like the White House, heard of it, and Oxford University, and is a champion for LGBTQ+ rights. He's pursuing a PhD in biblical studies at Drew University, and he joins us today to talk about his new book, Queer Christian, Reclaiming the Bible, Our Faith, and Our Place at the Table. Let's get into it with Brandon. Reverend Brandon Robertson, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a joy to be here.
Yeah, well, it's a privilege to have you, and I know you've been writing and speaking for a long time on many issues of Christian faith, including LGBTQ inclusion and deconstruction, etc. But maybe by way of introduction for those in our audience who are less familiar with you and your story, would you share briefly about kind of your upbringing? Were you raised in a Christian home? How is it the faith you live today in concert with or in contrast to that faith? I'd love to hear some of that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I actually have, I think the uniquest part of my journey is that I didn't grow up religious at all. My family was generally, like, we would have called ourselves Christians, but didn't go to church, never was taught Bible stories or anything like that. But I was also surrounded by a lot of abuse and alcoholism. And so by the age of 12, I found myself struggling pretty intensely with mental health issues. And it was at that period that my neighbors, a few trailers up from us, invited me to come to church with them. And they went to an independent, fundamentalist, Bible-believing Baptist church. Those are their words, not mine. And it was really in that context that for the first time I heard a message of good news, that the pain that I had experienced in my life could be redeemed and that God had a plan for me. And that really brought inspiration and healing and hope to my young soul. And that began this journey. I walked down the aisle, gave my heart to Jesus, and then within a few months really felt a distinct sense of calling to give my life to proclaim this message that had changed my life to everybody that I could. So really from 12 years old till now, I'm almost 33, I've been on this journey towards pastoral ministry. But like so many of us, when I went off to college, I studied at the Moody Bible Institute, studying to be a pastor. And while I was there, I kept finding that the theology I had grown up with, the theology I was learning at Moody, was coming into conflict with reality around me. We would leave campus and go out into the city of Chicago, and I would find God in all the places God wasn't supposed to be, according to my theology. Mm. And so that began what has been a 15-year journey of deconstruction. Also in that period, I started wrestling with my own faith and sexuality. Lots we can go into there, but at Moody, I did conversion therapy. I tried everything I could to follow the straight and narrow path. And once I graduated Moody, I really had my come to Jesus moment, both about sexuality and about whether or not I could still be part of this evangelical tradition. And spoiler alert, I came out and I'm no longer an evangelical. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, your latest book is Queer Christian, and it's not the first book you've written about LGBTQ issues and being a Christian, etc. So what gave rise to this latest book? Maybe another way to ask that is, what are you covering here or doing here that you feel like is building off or an extension of your previous work?
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to write this book. I thought I had said everything I wanted to say about LGBT and Christianity. I've written a theological book. I've written a book about how churches can become more inclusive. But I got this new publisher and they said, we'll let you write about whatever you want for your second book. But for your first book, you've got to write about homosexuality in the Bible. It's kind of your thing. And so I begrudgingly went into writing this book. But as I wrote it, I became super grateful because I realized that my own perspective on these issues has changed dramatically in the last decade. I'm currently in a PhD program studying New Testament, sexuality and gender, and that has been changing my entire perspective on this issue. But also there's this moment that we're actually in the broader LGBT Christian movement, where there's a bit of a split taking place between those who believe that the best path forward is just to help gay people reconcile with the six Bible verses and then take their place in traditional Christianity. And then there's this other group, which is where I've ended up and where I found so many other folks moving with me in this direction, where we're just not all that interested anymore in just being included in the same old Christian systems that we were rejected from. And in fact, a lot of us have become more skeptical of broader questions beyond sexuality and gender. And it's kind of where a lot of deconstructionist type folks are at. And so this book really is coming from that place of saying, okay, you can reconcile your faith with the Bible verses. And we do that in one section of this book. But then what does it actually look like to take this concept of queering, which I define in the first chapter as not necessarily about sexuality and gender, but about being at odds with systems of conformity. How do we take that queer posture and apply that to our Christian faith in every area? And so I hope that this book actually becomes way more than a gay Christian book, but an invitation to straight Christians and gay Christians and non-Christians to reclaim the tools of Christianity, the Bible, the tradition, from a queer lens, from a lens of exploration and creativity, so that we can make it a life-giving faith in the face of those that are using it as a weapon against not just queer people, but so many other people in this moment.
Brandon, I'd love to dive into that because part of your work here is in the subtitle, Reclaiming the Bible, right? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this kind of in two ways. Like one, the Bible has often been used against LGBTQ people in general and Christians in particular. But then as someone who's known as a progressive Christian, the word on the street is some circles, you know, the progressive Christian, they don't care about the Bible at all. And so I just would love to hear why reclaiming scripture is an important project.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I have two answers. I'll say when I wrote this book, my life, I now live in New York City, and most of my friends and the communities I live in are not Christian. They're almost entirely LGBTQ. And so when I was writing this book, I was thinking about what message do I have as the Christian pastor at the gay bar on a Friday night to my queer friends? And one of the messages of this book that I really hammer in the beginning is I think all queer people and all people that are allies of queer people, Christian or not, have a responsibility to reclaim the Bible. And I know that is a little shocking to some folks, but right now the Bible is the most influential book in human history, and it will continue to be the most influential book in human history. And the Bible is the singular text that governments and religions around the world draw on to pass legislation and to create theology that condemns queer people. And in America, we're seeing a rise in homophobia, transphobia, but I worked on a board at the State Department a few years ago looking at religion and global affairs, and we learned how many countries around the world have essentially theocratic governments that are legislating the death penalty for queer people. And that's happening today in 2025. Mm-hmm. And they're doing it based on the Bible. So I think there's a responsibility if we care about queer people around the world, if we care about women around the world, if we care about all the people that have been marginalized by scripture, we've got to equip people to know how to reclaim the Bible, to wrest it from the hands of those that are using it as a weapon. Even if you don't believe it's the word of God, even if you don't ever care to read it, I think we should be conversant in the Bible. So that's one thing I hoped to do with this book is make it one, show folks that the Bible is interesting enough to want to dig into, but also like at the end of each section on the Bible, I do a call out box that like in two sentences explains the argument because I want people to know how to talk about this. The other side of it is this. The more I've studied the Bible, and I love it a lot, I've got 3 degrees in it, I'm getting a PhD, $100,000 of student loans in the Bible. No one can question whether I like the Bible. And I fall more in love with it the more I read it because the Bible is this amazing library of texts that were written by people who were oppressed, for people who are oppressed, about liberation from oppression. That is literally the message from Genesis to Revelation that is the gospel proclamation of Jesus. And if we can encourage folks to engage the Bible critically, creatively, not like evangelicals do, I don't believe it's the inerrant word of God, and that's why evangelicals think that we don't take it seriously. But if you actually look at how Christians and Jews have used the Bible for 4,000 years almost at this point, it's been in this creative, generative way where you wrestle with the text and debate with the text and disagree with the text. And that is what I've come to love. And I wanted to invite those who still identify as Christian to come back to the Bible, but this time with fresh eyes, this time with no rules. You get to explore it, learn from it, and disagree with it. And when you allow people to do that, I think they have a more dynamic relationship with the Bible. I see it in my church. People love Bible study now. It's my biggest event. I can't get them to come to Sunday service, but you better believe they pack out Bible study. So, yeah. Funny.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation. Let's get back to the show.
You're pointing out something out that I think in my journey sort of out of evangelicalism, I was one of my realizations is that this sort of way of reading the Bible that I was taught was very traditional and conservative and, you know, like it is very new. It's actually very new to kind of look at the Bible as this like airtight, like instructions, you know, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And this relates a little bit to the question I want to ask you, because you walk through some of the famous so-called clobber passages that have been used against LGBTQ people. And I hope we get a chance to talk a little bit about that. But first you have this chapter in your book that says how the Bible became anti-queer. And I think that will surprise people that it was, you know, or that it ever was anything other than, you know, anti-queer. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I always say when answering a question about this that my dear friends at the 1946 documentary have done more for this conversation than anybody else has. So many people in progressive social media will know of 1946, this great documentary that basically uncovered the story of how the word homosexual ended up in the English Bible for the first time. And I do a little recap of that history in this chapter. But essentially, the word arsenikoitai in the New Testament is a word that the Apostle Paul makes up. It doesn't exist in the Greek language. And so anybody who's ever translated that word has had to make an educated guess about what exactly Paul was talking about, because we have no other reference for what that word means. And throughout history, it's been interpreted and translated in many different ways, from child abuser, boy molester, prostitutes, all sorts of words like that, but never exclusively same-sex sex, like never exclusively loving consensual same-sex relationships, or broadly homosexuality as a sexual orientation. And the reason it was never translated like that is because the concept of sexual orientation didn't exist until the late 1800s, when psychology began to develop and understand that there are these innate parts of our human identity. Sexuality is one of them. And that this is an innate part that's not something you choose and it's not something you change. So when the Revised Standard Version Translation Committee was doing an updated English edition of the Bible, they did what all good translators do. They tried to make the modern translation sound modern and relate to modern people. And there was this new concept called homosexuality that was floating around in public consciousness that was about people that are supposedly born loving the same sex. And so they said, well, that sounds like arsenikoitai, men who lie with men, is essentially what that word meant. And they said, this must be homosexuality. That's our modern word that works for that. And they put that word in the Bible. Within 50 years, almost every other English translation followed suit and translated arsenikoitai as homosexual. But within, I think, 15 years, the Revised Standard Version Committee comes back and realizes they were wrong and they regret their translation mistake and they change that word from homosexuality. And even if you look, the new Revised Standard Version updated edition just came out last year, which is three translations down the line from the first Revised Standard Version, and they completely remove the word homosexuality or any reference to anything similar to homosexuality because they recognized that was an improper translation. But the damage had been done, and most English Bibles still contain the word homosexuality.
Yeah, fascinating. I don't know that a lot of our listeners will know that, and so I think that's a really important aspect of your book.
Thank you.
I do want to get to these clobber passages, Brandon, and I'm going to ask maybe when you went back to look at them again, what new discoveries or surprises? Maybe pick one passage. And what new discoveries or surprises did you make? But before we get there, I think your previous answer begs the question. See what I did there, Ben?
Long story here.
No, it asks for the question. Is that better, Ben?
Thank you.
You're welcome. That Greek word, what is it referring to? How would you translate it? And what was Paul, what got his, you know, pants in a wad about it? Why was it so bad?
I think I'm going to answer all of your questions in this answer.
Okay, cool.
So it's actually remarkably simple how to interpret all six of the Colibri passages, because they're all referring to the same thing. And it is the thing that Paul is referring to as arsenokoitai. What I'll say is this. In the Greek language of the first century, there were up to 16, there's a debate about like 12 to 16 words that referred to things like homosexuality. The concept of sexual orientation didn't exist, so none of them were about an innate sexual orientation, but there were words for men who had sex with men, women who had sex with women, and a wide variety of other sexual behaviors. Paul chooses none of those words that everyone in his context would have understood and creates a word out of a translation of the Greek Septuagint. Leviticus 18:22 says, "An arson shall not coiten with an arson, for this is an abomination." In other words, a man shall not bed with a man, for this is an abomination. Paul combines arson and coiten together and makes man better, which is the literal translation of that word. So whatever Leviticus 18:22 is referring to is what Paul is referring to with arsenokoitai. At least that's what most scholars today believe. And Leviticus 18:22, if read in complete context, Leviticus 18 verses 1 through 3 says, "Do not do as they do in the land of Egypt where I am bringing you from, and do not do as they do in the land of Canaan where I am bringing you to. Do not follow their customs." So the question we have to ask is, where in ancient Egypt and ancient Canaan did men bed with men as with women? Well, if you simply look at the law codes of both of those societies, you'll find that homosexuality is prohibited. Same-sex relationships are prohibited. They were not common. You have a few rogue examples that some people throw in sometimes in Egypt where it seems like there may have been a prominent same-sex couple, but the law is clear. The only time same-sex sex was permitted in those cultures was for men of a high status to sexually exploit and abuse their slaves. And that was permitted in most ancient cultures all the way up through ancient Rome. And in fact, it was more prevalent in Paul's world in ancient Rome. Men were literally legally allowed to have sex with any man, woman, or child who was of a lower social status than they were. And it was not immoral, completely legal. Slaves in particular had no rights as human beings, so men would have sex with whoever they wanted. That's what Leviticus must be condemning, because that was the wide practice in ancient Egypt and ancient Canaan, not gay marriages. And we know for a fact that in Rome and in Corinth, two of the biggest passages that are often referenced by non-affirming people, both of those cultures were known for their sexual excess and the amount of kind of this debaucherous, free-flowing sex between men and men, women and women, men and different people of different ages. So it makes sense that Paul is looking at this culture, seeing them just like the ancient Egyptians and Canaanites, worshiping false gods, and saying, your idolatry has debased your mind so much that you're having sex with anyone and everyone, exploiting people, abusing people. And he thinks that this is a result of the judgment of God, people's hearts being turned from God. And he creates a new word to describe this particular idolatrous, exploitative, debaucherous sexual relationship, but doesn't use all the other words for consensual sexual relationships or marriage relationships. And I think that's kind of the smoking gun in this is Paul was a man that was trying to communicate to lay people, so to speak. And in this one instance, he doesn't use the most common language, but creates language clearly referring to something other than consensual, loving, sexual relationships. Yeah,
Brandon, that was so cogent, man. Yeah. Four and a half minutes.
Well done.
Yeah. Super helpful.
I've been saying it for 10 years now, so I'm getting it.
you've got a tight 4 minutes.
Yeah, it's really good. Not quite an elevator pitch, but maybe a stair.
We'll get there.
Maybe a stair pitch. Yeah.
Yes.
Really long elevator ride.
Well, in part three of your book, there's an exploration of how queer people are represented in scripture. Mm. We can't get into all of the stories, but I'm curious if you could just pick one of the stories that you tell in your book and unpack it for us a bit, and how that story helps the queer community see themselves and be seen.
I love that. Thank you. I want to start off by saying I was somebody who 5 years ago rolled my eyes whenever I heard someone say, "Did you know David and Jonathan were gay?" I'm not a huge fan of kind of the anachronistic forcing categories onto the Bible or ancient world. And yet, what I've discovered in my own PhD program is every community interprets the Bible from within their community. Every community sees themselves in the pages of the Bible. We do this. I mean, this is like every preacher that stands up and says, tells the David and Goliath story and says, "What is your Goliath and what giants are you facing in your life?" This is a common and fine way to engage with the Bible. And yet, the queer community, even in progressive circles, has generally been said to not be allowed to try to find parallels to our own experiences in the Bible. But if you look at the queer community throughout the last 50 years, there have been so many scholars and saints that have been doing this work. Just like if you look at the Black liberationist community, there are Black recastings of biblical stories and indigenous recastings of biblical stories. And I think that's good. It helps people reclaim the Bible for themselves. So what I did is basically I chose five different Bible characters who either did transgress gender and cultural boundaries of their world. And in that case, I think they truly are rendered what we mean when we say queer, or characters who have stories that parallel the queer experience. And so the one story I'll point to is Jacob or Joseph, I always mess it up and I wrote the book on it. Jacob and his dream coat, right? His coat of many colors.
Yeah. Joseph. That's Joseph. Yeah.
Got it. Thank you.
Jacob was the guy with the ladder.
Yes.
The ladder. So that always helps me.
Sunday schools. Yeah, blending together. Okay, Joseph and his coat. Many scholars in the Jewish tradition have noted for many, many, many years that the word kenet pesim, which is translated coat in some translations, is also used in the Bible to refer to a dress worn by women. And so there's always been this tension in the story, especially in the Jewish tradition, about what is it that Joseph is wearing and how does that merit the response of hatred from his brothers in the community? And so I, like many others, have lifted that story up and said, well, one, the trans experience or non-binary experience can be represented here. You have a boy who doesn't fit in, whose dad sees him and recognizes the difference in his son. But instead of condemning his son, he affirms his son by giving him this garment, this special garment that does not fit his gender identity and would have been culturally strange. Joseph's brothers react by rejecting him, mocking him, attempting to kill him. And Joseph yet continues on this journey of pursuing being authentic to who he is, living out the calling that he has. And it's this beautiful story that at the end of it, through the witness of Joseph, his brothers' hearts are changed. They come around. And this young boy who was bullied for the way he showed up in the world now becomes this incredible saint. There are so many parallels in that story to the trans experience, but to the coming out journey. And I say in the book, like, this is a lesson for parents of queer children. Joseph's father is a great example of how you should respond to your child if they show up and they're not fitting gender boundaries and their sexuality is not the way it should be according to your church or culture. Joseph's father steps in, affirms, protects, and calls forth the true identity of Joseph. And yes, he still faces bullying and hardship and even a physical assault. But it's the persistence to his authentic self that actually enables Joseph to become this incredible saint. That's just one example. The biggest one that I do is I end it talking about Jesus and his beloved disciple, and I know that's one that's going to make a lot of people eyebrows raise. But the scholarship is clear that Jesus queered gender in the first century. Nothing yeah. about how Jesus embodied masculinity aligned with first century Jewish standards. And so there's an opening for us to say, well, could Jesus be a queer? Can queer people see themselves in the face of Jesus in the same way that heterosexuals have always seen themselves in the face of Jesus? So all of that is to say, this section is just the permission slip and an invitation to queer people to put on our lenses and to see where we might see ourselves reflected in some of these amazing scriptural stories.
Thank you for that. There's several stories that you, we don't want to go into all of them because we want people to buy your book and be able to read it for themselves. So I thank you for that.
Yeah.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
So I was just revisiting the story of Mary, who had the perfume and the nard, right? And anointed Jesus's feet and used her hair, right? And this is a little off topic, Brandon, but there is a well-known euphemism in Judaism where feet is a euphemism for genitals. And hair is a sexual symbol, right? So women would keep their hair up as a sign of modesty, and women who had their hair down, it was a sign of like sexual availability. And I'm just thinking through Jesus celebrating a woman with her hair down, wiping his feet with her hair. And how that goes to your point, there is there's a number of taboos there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think exactly to your point, the problem, and this is why I'm resistant to this kind of reforming the church kind of language, because the Jesus of the institutionalized Christian church has so thoroughly been ripped from the subversive context that we actually see when you study the scripture in culture and context. Jesus cannot be tamed. Jesus breaks all the boundaries. He is a taboo in the way he shows up in the world. Yeah. And Christianity, when we can embrace that radical, subversive, trickster nature, I preached on that last week for Palm Sunday, Jesus is always tricking people as a subversion of power, as a subversion of the systems of this world. That's the faith I want to be a part of. That's what compels me about Jesus. And you just can't do that in the systems that are set up to keep people in power with jobs, paying bills, having buildings. Like, Jesus has to exist on the outside of the institution, and he did exist on the outside of the institution. And I'll get off my soapbox there, but thank you for that.
That's good.
Already preached that sermon. I think... you know, we have members of the LGBTQ community in our church. Matt and I pastor a church together. And there, you know, several of them are active in the Gravity Commons online community, all that kind of thing. There's a lot of these people who are looking for a way into the Christian faith. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, you know, I think our conversation so far has probably been very encouraging for them, but do you have any specific advice or encouragement, that you would offer to someone who's grappling with their sexual identity and then the dominant messages that tend to pathologize that identity? You know, what have you found helpful as you've found your way into this faith?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing, and this will be obvious to folks that are already a part of your community, is that communities like yours exist. I am consistently surprised as a pastor of a church as well that people don't know progressive Christianity exists. Like, literally don't know it exists. And so many people, especially in the queer community, are rightly skeptical because a lot of churches today, most evangelical churches today, will use very inclusive, welcoming language and really deceive people until they're too far in to just back out. And it really hurts a lot of folks. So I would just say, I always recommend there's this great website, gaychurch.net. It's not about gay churches. It's about inclusive, affirming churches. And it's got this database of thousands of churches that exist that are all LGBT inclusive, but are also all progressive and really safe places for people to step back into faith. But the other thing is, and I think most progressive pastors will resonate with this, queer people, when you enter back into the church, I don't think it's necessary nor necessarily good to be going in feeling like you need to recommit to being a part of a church community forever. In my book, True Inclusion, I talk about the first church I pastored where we had what we call the revolving door policy, where it was like, we want people to come in, experience what it looks like to be a part of an inclusive community, get healed. And some people stay, but some people leave and have spirituality outside of it. I'm an advocate for the church as a pastor. I think community is more necessary than ever in these days. And queer folks, just like all folks, are looking for places of community, and inclusive churches can be that. But a lot of people are too afraid to step back into the church because they've only learned how to do Christianity in a context that requires this rigid conformity and full commitments four times a week, like a very legalistic version of religion. And I like to encourage queer people, like us inclusive churches, us pastors in these churches are more than happy to have you come in, explore, experiment. And like, we're not looking for you to sign your life away to join our community in the same way that evangelical churches are. So it's just the encouragement that what feels too good to be true is actually true, that communities like this actually do exist, and that there are safe spaces that will allow you to experiment and play with and find a way of being Christian that actually heals your soul and connects you to God.
I feel like I need that too.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a human need. Yeah. Brandon, as we wind up here, part four, you have kind of a commonly asked questions section, and there's some really great topics you cover. Maybe one that I've had some experience with, and I'm curious to hear more of your thoughts, is many of us are in ecclesial spaces where people disagree about LGBTQ inclusion. For many years, I was in a non-inclusive space and tried without success to de-weaponize non-inclusion, right? And it didn't go well for me. But what have you learned about being in relationship, even Christian fellowship, with traditionalist queer Christians or side B, what's typically called a side B queer Christian, or with non-affirming Christians? Like, what does Brandon in his mid-30s know now that he didn't know 10 years ago about that?
This is a really hard question for me, honestly, because at my heart, I am a bridge builder. At my heart, I am somebody who I feel called to enter into relationships that are very difficult and enter into conversations that are very difficult. And I am convinced that that is not a calling for everybody. It is not necessary or good for everybody to be defending themselves to their non-affirming family every Thanksgiving. And I do think that there is, people need permission to be able to build boundaries and to say, I'm not going to go have coffee with that childhood pastor that keeps asking to meet with me. So there's that side of me that says, I want to jump into those conversations because I feel equipped to handle them. And I've done my own psychological work to not be impacted in traumatic ways, but I don't think that's for everybody. However, the one thing I do know is that demonizing doesn't get us anywhere. And I am on the receiving end of conservative demonizing on a daily basis. And I know it only makes me more angry and upset and unwilling to listen to somebody who's calling me an antichrist and whatever. And so I also want to invite queer folks to resist demonizing people who have come to different conclusions. Side B Christians are those that say, I'm gay, but I still believe it's a sin to be in relationships or have sex. To them, I say, if you're an adult and you're choosing that, more power to you. Like, I don't have to agree with how you're choosing to live your life. The problem is, and I do draw a very hard line in this book, is the contingent of folks that claim to be ex-gay, who claim to have been healed of their sexuality. I believe that is a lie. the opening sentence of the chapter is ex-gays don't exist, and that gets a lot of controversy. But I've never met, ever, somebody who says, I've been delivered from my sexuality such that I don't have attractions anymore. And in fact, my friend Alan Chambers, the former president of Exodus International, the largest ex-gay ministry in the world, shut it down 10 years ago, saying he never saw a single person change their sexual orientation or gender identity. And so for that community, that's the only one I have a little bit more clause with, because I do think that there is an intentional deception that is taking place when you're going into the world telling people they can heal themselves of their sexuality, because as somebody who tried that and it didn't work, the psychological spiral that you go on when it feels like you've tried to do the right thing and you can't heal yourself, that leads to suicide, that leads to all of the terrible psychological consequences. And so I do think conversion therapy and ex-gay folks, there does need to be a strong boundary, and we do need to not be afraid to mince words and say, this is not true. If you want to say you're choosing to not live out your same-sex attraction because you believe it's a sin, I say more power to you. But when you start telling people that you've been healed and that they should be healed or could be healed, I think that is where we cross into a line of deception that is actually very harmful. So
yeah.
I don't know if that's actually a great answer.
I think what your answer is illustrating is that there's a large strata of various people who make up the queer community who have various different convictions about how to relate to their queerness. And there are some that you feel like you can abide and tolerate difference, but then there's some difference. What I hear you saying is there's some difference that actually causes harm and damage.
Yeah.
And that you're unwilling to abide that for justice sake. Right.
Yeah. It's the paradox of intolerance, right? You cannot tolerate the intolerance.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Brandon, I first encountered your writing about 7 years ago, I think 5 years ago. You were responding to N.T. Wright, Tom Wright, some of his research on ancient homosexual practice. And it was so helpful for me. It was so cogent and so clear. And I've benefited greatly from your work and your witness and your ministry from afar. It's great to actually talk to you. And before we go, you're known as the TikTok pastor. Would you tell us a little bit more about that?
I mean, it's a strange story of during the pandemic, I was pastoring a church and all of a sudden I had a lot of time on my hands because we weren't meeting. And so I started doing nerdy theological videos on TikTok. And the amazing thing that I think you all probably have found too, we've all kind of awoken to this reality that the younger generations, and I feel so old saying that, but the younger generations, they want theological depth. They want robust conversations. And literally within like 6 months, 100,000 people were following this account where all I did was talk about my theology. And that has only grown over the years. And it's not about me. Like, I think there's so many amazing progressive Christian voices that have emerged. And you're seeing these massive digital spaces of millions of young people primarily engaging in robust theological conversation. And that makes my nerdy theological heart so happy. Yeah. And I think it's a good thing for our future, especially when nationalist Christianity is on the rise, when you have a generation that's willing to do the work to learn the truth and a different way of seeing Christianity. It's why I do what I do.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's awesome. Well, the book again is called Queer Christian, Reclaiming the Bible, Our Faith, and Our Place at the Table. Brandon, it was great to spend time with you today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you all so much.
I told you, Ben. I told you that'd be good. No, I didn't. I didn't tell you that'd be good. I didn't tell you anything about that. That was awesome.
Yeah, that was great. A great conversation.
Yeah, I'm really glad we got to talk to him.
Mm-hmm. Astute and loyal listeners of the podcast will realize that we haven't done a lot of conversations around LGBTQ things. Part of that is because it feels like a huge bruise on the body of Christ, that many of us come out of traditions that don't talk about it at all. Many of us have walked away from churches because of how the church has talked about it. Many of us feel like we're excluded because of our gender or sexual identity.
Yeah.
And then it really is like a no-fly zone. Like it's so weaponized that we can't even talk about it without making sure we say the right things to the right people in the right ways. And one of the beautiful things that God is doing at Gravity Commons is there's a great diversity of people, and I think a diversity of convictions, that, I don't know, seems like it's not beholden to this ideological or cultural war around sexuality. And it's precious, and I don't want to like screw it up. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to do anything to compromise that. So I've just felt like a little insecurity.
Yeah.
Honestly, like I don't want to do the wrong thing, screw up something that's precious.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Does that make sense, you guys?
Yeah, it does to me. I resonate with that sense of like wanting to tread carefully, wanting not to activate a bruise unnecessarily.
Yeah. But also it does feel like, and Brandon referenced this, that there is a renewed or an increasing focus on particularly trans people,
right,
in our culture. And, you know, as someone who, as someone who cares deeply about everyone, but also the trans people in my life and the trans people in all y'all's lives, mm-hmm. It feels like there comes a time when you have to move towards something for the sake of justice and goodness,
yeah,
even if you don't quite know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because to not do anything is to abide wrongdoing.
Yeah.
I think part of my hesitation or fear around conversations like this is that I don't want to talk in general and have labels. Like I have friends and they have names and, yeah, and like, I get nervous that like, as we try to talk and untangle some things in our hearts, maybe even, mm-hmm, that like it would somehow like just not be kind because it's too general and it's not like the person. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Like talking about all gay people,
right,
at once, or talking about gay people as an issue or topic, even, yes, depersonalizing,
mm-hmm,
it.
Yes, it's, yeah, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tricky. Something that Brandon mentioned that I am finding myself increasingly thinking about is using the word queer, not to just describe a group of people and how they identify, but to describe a relationship to the status quo.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Or the dominant order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That there is this sort of creative transgression. And I get really fired up about that. Like, because I do think, he mentioned Jesus as a trickster.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that so much of what Jesus was doing was creatively opposing harmful, dominant, ordinary ways of being.
Yeah.
And using the word queer to name that activity or to name that work of justice even, mm-hmm, makes me excited. Like, I get excited about it. Then I also feel a little bit like, oh, is it appropriation for me to, you know what I mean? Like,
right. Yeah, you're a queer person. So is that, yeah, yeah, I get what you're saying.
You know what? I don't want to Elvis Presley the black music. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for sure. I like that too. I think I've always been attracted to that kind of prophetic speech. and this is probably apropos of nothing, but I think that there is a way in which, have you guys ever seen the Borat movies?
I've seen clips.
Yeah.
No.
But every time I wanted to watch a Borat movie, I felt like my sanctification couldn't bear it.
Yeah, I would not recommend it, listener, per se. But I do find one of the interesting things that he does in those films. Well, I'll just name the specific thing that I'm thinking of. He goes to this rodeo, and he is, I can't remember the time frame. I think it was the Iraq War was going on. And so he goes to this rodeo in Texas, and they think he's, you know, I don't know if you guys know the thing about Borat, but he's pretending to be a journalist from Kazakhstan who's coming to America to, like, you know, do a little tour and kind of find out what's going on in America. And he sort of outwardly very much appeals to this kind of, you know, what we might now call like a MAGA conservative, you know, kind of thing outwardly. But he does this thing at this rodeo where he gets a little chance to speak. I don't know how rodeos work. It's like halftime. Is there a rodeo? Is there a halftime rodeo? But he gets a chance to speak at this rodeo in front of all these people. And, you know, he's saying, like, we support your war of terror. You know, he's like making these subtle, and they're like, wait, isn't it the war on terror? And they're like cheering for him. And then he just goes over the top, and they eventually realize what he's doing, that he's sort of lampooning their position a little bit, right? They eventually realize that they're cheering for, you know, eventually he starts saying things like, may your president bathe his feet in the blood of his enemies, you know, and they're like, yeah, I don't know about that one, right? You know, they're anyway, and he actually is in danger. He's in danger of his life at the end of this clip, because he's doing all this like in real life, you know what I mean? So these people have been tricked real time, and they are angry enough to like do him some harm after the rodeo, like in the film. So anyway, it's not a perfect analogy because I'd never want to compare Jesus to Borat. But there's something trickstery about Borat that I think is fascinating.
Does he ride off from the rodeo on a steer?
No, it's
holding on with one hand.
It's a donkey. He rides off on a donkey and they lay palm branches in front of him. It's kind of weird. So
listener, that may have been the first time that you heard how homosexuality came into the Bible, and the brief exegesis that the good Reverend Brandon gave us about this term that Paul invents and what he thinks it refers to. Just want to invite a conversation about that. I think the Commons is a good place to talk about that. And honestly, in terms of accessibility and quick read, short chapters, this is a great book. So if this is something you want to look more into and you like a good sort of introduction to how queer Christians and gay Christians are thinking about the Bible and their faith, I commend it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, talking about the Bible, I did learn something. I didn't know that God really likes coffee.
Oh, yeah. He brews.
Come on. Oh. Come on, people. That wasn't even kind, Matt. I was doing my best.
My
wow. Listener, please send me a joke so I can get Matt.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yep. Look, I got them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do.
I got those jokes.
All dumb dad jokes, you know.
So dumb.
I should have known that.
So dumb.
Christy, I'm sorry. I should have let you have that.
You should have.
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Please forgive me.
Next time. It's okay. All right. Well, with that, friends, have a great day.
Yeah. See you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.